So now we have, I'd like to introduce David Casagrande. He received his master's degree in ecology and biodiversity conservation from Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and a PhD in ecological anthropology from the University of Georgia. He's currently an assistant professor of environmental anthropology at Western Illinois University. He has published peer-reviewed articles and book chapters on topics such as human ecosystems, cultural transmission of ecological knowledge, ecological restoration, and that explicitly involves humans, urban ecology, environmental policy, and medicinal plants. He has conducted extensive research in Venezuela, Mexico, and post-industrial cities in the U.S. Oh, and here you go.
Thank you, Jackie. For those of you who don't know, we're podcasting. That's what this is all about. It's not helping you here, but perhaps you can watch the podcast later. But fortunately, they quieted down outside, so we don't have too much competition. My talk is going to piggyback on Jeff's a little bit, because I'm going to touch on this issue of the drought that he had mentioned. Is anybody here from the American Southwest in one of these really arid regions? Phoenix in particular? Texas doesn't count. They have lots of water. Okay, so I have to watch what I say about people from the Southwest then. These are a few photos from Phoenix, if you're familiar with the area. You appreciate the extreme heterogeneity in the types of landscapes people can have in their yards, and it becomes quite an expression of identity. This, believe it or not, is a neighborhood in Gilbert, Arizona, a suburb of Phoenix. It's called Val Vista Lakes, and it is modeled after Miami. And as you drive through this community, there are these party boats and all this kind of thing. And the streets are named Key Biscayne Boulevard and things like that. And then, of course, at the other extreme are people who are trying to live with the desert. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the issues that are involved with this. And in keeping with the conference theme of security, I decided to talk a little bit today about economic and political security in the Phoenix area, the metropolitan area. And in a nutshell, what we have, for those of you who haven't been there, the population is exploding in metropolitan Phoenix. We have a growing population. We have a constant, or now, policymakers are talking about a potentially decreasing water supply. And so, as you can see, that's setting up a possibly insecure scenario. And so we've been doing research at Arizona State University. I was a postdoc there. I forgot to put that in my bio. I was a postdoc there until a few years ago, and Amber, who you'll hear from, is now a postdoc there also. And so I'm involved in a project there that's funded by the National Science Foundation called the Long-Term Ecological Research Project, where we're looking at Phoenix as an ecosystem, a human ecosystem. So that's where all of this is coming from. So in this particular aspect of the research, I pulled out of a lot of the data these three important processes that I think are possibly leading to decreased security from an economic and political perspective. The population has grown very rapidly from about 75,000 people in 1950 to roughly 3.6 million today. That's quite a feat of logistic engineering. Getting all those people in the landscape, and it kind of looks like this. It just keeps eating into the desert, although a lot of it is agriculture that's being converted within the city limits. Some of the higher projections are 10 million people by 2040. I'm going to use one of the more conservative projections by the Maricopa Association of Governments. That puts it at about 6 million. They call that the build-out scenario, where they're going to double the population of Phoenix from 3 million to 6 million in the next 30 or 40 years. That's a lot of growth. Where does the water come from? It comes from three different places. There's the Salt River system is a system of reservoirs that traditionally fed Phoenix with its water. Also wells sucking up groundwater, and then with the Central Arizona Project bringing Colorado River water into Phoenix, that has become a major source also. Now, as Jeff had alluded to, we're in a drought in the Southwest. Some people in Phoenix would put it at a 5-year drought, some at an 8-year drought. They're certainly saying it's about the worst in 500 years based on tree ring data. The question is, when will it end? A lot of the reservoirs are about half capacity. Now, the thing I want to point out is this last idea, that a lot of the water that comes into these reservoirs comes from snowmelt and not necessarily rain. And when we talk about global climate change in this area, even if it continues to rain, it's going to mean less. If the same amount of precipitation falls, but not as snow, it's going to end up being less water in these reservoirs. I'll spare you the hydrological details on that. It has something to do with infiltration rates and evaporation and all this kind of stuff. Okay, now why focus on landscaping behavior? I mean, certainly this is a policy, the policy experts who messed this up. Well, actually, they planned that if the situation was predictable, that there would be enough water. They have what they call a diverse water portfolio with these three different sources. So it's really, the focus now is on landscaping behavior. That's what the policymakers would like us to find out more about. Landscapes are also a very important expression of identity and personal security. It represents a very important interface between the public and policymakers. So just to give you an idea of how much water folks in Phoenix use, the average number of gallons per person per day we use in the country is about 100. Phoenix is about twice that amount, and that's primarily a result of outdoor landscaping behavior, because inside the houses they've gotten quite efficient. A lot of the newer houses are more efficient, toilets and this type of thing. Paradise Valley is one of these suburbs, these really she suburbs like Scottsdale and whatnot. They're up around 400,000. I don't have time to go into it now, but so is Salt Lake City and some other areas. About 40% of the water is used for residential landscaping, and hence your water policy people tend to say things like, per capita water reduction to meet this growth will require a change in lifestyle expectations. And one of the things I kept hearing and wanted to go into the data and look for was this idea that we need to get people away from thinking about Phoenix as an oasis, which is visually what you see all around. Now, basically what needs to happen is, in order to meet that 2040 goal, the people in Phoenix are going to have to reduce the number of gallons they use per day from 226 down to about 90. Using the most efficient technology we can put into households that they have now, we can get it down to about 40 gallons per person inside the house, which does leave 50 gallons for outside. So this is doable under the scenario. Well, doable if everybody cooperates, because this is the optimal use of current technologies. So folks are really going to have to buy into this system in order to achieve it. And again, these statistics here are for Phoenix. If you move over into Scottsdale and Paradise Valley, those people are going to have to come from 400 down to 90. Not likely. It also assumes non-residential demand is constant, farming, these types of things. Actually, that'll probably go down a little bit, so there is a buffer there. But the really important thing is it assumes that the supply of water remains constant. If that starts to decrease also, those goals are not going to be met. So let's talk a little bit about economic security for those of you who just might have bought a house in Phoenix. No? Okay, good. people buy houses. It's a place to park your equity. And this is the way when I interview people, this is kind of how I hear them talk about metropolitan Phoenix. It's a place to park their capital for a while. A lot of the growth in population are people from Southern California who are just selling these outrageously priced houses and buying these McMansions in Phoenix, and really don't want to be in Phoenix, don't need to be in Phoenix, but it's a really good place to park your capital for the time being. And it leads to what I don't have time to talk about today, which is a dearth of a sense of identity, sense of place in the area. Sorry, I got a little ahead of myself. And you hear people say things like this: we have plenty of water, just too many people. I don't know how much I'm personally willing to conserve before we'll leave. We're thinking of going back to California. Good luck. They're on the same water system, Colorado water system. But the important thing is that people think about, there's a lot of, for every five people that move to Phoenix, three leave within 5 years. The turnover in the population is very high. So this is a post-industrial, post-modern city. This is not like Detroit. Also, a lot of your jobs, the economy is very much based on growth. Think of 12% of the jobs are just based on building more houses and selling them. That's a large chunk of the economy. if something goes wrong and people stop buying for any reason, there's going to be an economic downturn pretty quickly. Water policy people don't talk about this. Some other people do. Okay, so property values in the regional economy may be vulnerable. And when I talk to people, they say, oh, it won't happen here. And I say, well, I'm sure that's what they said in Detroit in the 1950s. And for those of you who are familiar with Detroit, it's like a donut. There's a lot missing in the middle. And these other Rust Belt cities. I'm from New Haven, Connecticut, which is a classic Rust Belt city. So one of the things that's happening is they have noticed a reduction in snowpack. This is happening. It's not theoretical. It's definitely happening. Reservoirs are down, and they talk about us being in sort of a drought cycle that we could come out of. But if snowpack is reducing, the warming trend is not a cycle. That's going on. And so you see these, when these, you link up these two curves, you have a lot of insecurity about predicting a water. Okay, so all of those numbers I told you don't fit anymore if the water supply goes down. And I just came up with this. I'm so proud of myself. Could we be creating a dust belt, a scenario somewhat like the Rust Belt, which was really a result of public policies? Okay. I don't have time to go into this, but there are others. I know it's not all just water, but there are a lot of other reasons people are dissatisfied with Phoenix that could contribute to the problem also. I am taking these into account. So, boy, do I have enough time to talk about my research? what we were trying to do here was look at people's perceptions that are contributing to their landscape behavior. This is based on three sets of data. The Phoenix Area Social Survey was a large survey of 800 families distributed around Phoenix, done by Sharon Harlan and some others. Larissa Larson, who's now at Michigan. Sharon's still at Arizona State University. And then based on those results, we made a more detailed interview where we targeted 55 households, and then we did some very in-depth interviews and thematically analyzed those discursive data. Now, one of the things we did was we had them look at different computer-generated illustrations of their neighborhood. So this is like a house from one of their neighborhoods that I digitally alter. My girlfriend is a graphic artist. She did it. I couldn't do this. And we showed them these, and we had them rate them, how they like them, how they would feel about living in with them. And also, it's to give you an idea, particularly this thing called the oasis landscape, which is becoming very popular, where you have a little bit of grass and then this decomposing granite around it. It gives you a kind of a little oasis feel to your yard. Now, a few things I'm going to talk about. One is this human-desert dichotomy, which has just recently emerged from the data in the last several months. So if you came to my talk last year, there is something new. Past research done by other people suggested a bit of a paradox. And policymakers say it's these people from Michigan and back east that have to change their views. They all want to come here and have lawns. Well, as it turns out, one of the surveys again and again were showing that the longer you live in Phoenix, the less you want native desert landscaping, the more lawn you want. And so there's a bit of a we're trying to say, well, why? Why would this possibly be happening? Especially since in our survey, most people agreed, people who had lived there all their lives, the desert is beautiful, was one of the statements in our survey. But the question we're asking, would they want the desert in their yard? I'm sorry about the size of this, but I'll spare you all the details. We ran four different linear regression models on a bunch of variables to find out what might be contributing to the way people rated the different landscapes. And one of the things we found was that, indeed, the more years you lived in Phoenix, the less you liked these dry landscapes. So we found the same result. But people like the desert. They appreciate the aesthetics, beauty of the desert. So what's going on here? So we went into these narratives and tried to find what was happening. And basically, it seems like the longer you live in the Sonoran Desert, it's a little different from the Chihuahuan. We have real cactus, saguaros. The longer you live in the Sonoran Desert area, the more you really appreciate the desert as being a special place, and to put it in your yard is to cheapen it. Okay, and this is what sort of these quotes are, I think, referring to. The desert is great in its place. And so they really appreciate the desert, and they don't really see these desert landscapes as being real desert, which is interesting because that sort of syncs up with what biologists, how they would think about it also. And also there's the issue of you don't necessarily want a lot of plants like saguaro cactus in your yard that where it's going to hurt children. Which gets us to these ideas of family values. And when people talk, they also talk about grass as being a family thing. And this is originally I said this talk about legacy effects that we have that keep us sort of on track. And the lawn family ideal, I think, is a really powerful one. And one of the things we found was that people who had a lot of children were much more likely to choose the full lawn scenario in those landscapes. Okay, and interestingly enough, women were the least likely to choose the desert landscapes, and they talked about things like, you know, we're afraid of our kids being impaled on a saguaro. Okay, so the mesic landscape, I'm sorry, the mesic is the really wet, lush grass landscape, is the ideal family situation. Okay, now I'm briefly going to touch upon this idea of the oasis mentality. Different people, we also analyze policy, people's narratives and speeches and talks and presentations, and they talk about the oasis, and certainly a lot of the people we interview think of Phoenix as an oasis. Let me back up just a little bit. Environmental values, we had hoped if people expressed high environmental values on the Dunlop new ecological paradigm scale we applied, you know, if you know that one. We had hoped that that would lead people who had high, strong environmental values to choose the desert landscapes, and it didn't. It did tend to make them not choose the full lawn scenario, but not move them all the way over into the desert. And so we are wondering if this oasis idea becomes a compromise. You know it's not the right thing to do, but the family value idea is making you want grass. And so you compromise in the middle on this oasis. And when we went back and we coded all of the interviews for areas where we thought people, we could hear them trying to make a compromise, we looked at what the different themes were. And there were a lot. Usually when they chose the oasis, it was based on some sort of compromise that they were making. This idea of the oasis as a compromise, I think, fits very well with the history of marketing Phoenix as, and if you look back, you know, to the 1950s and the 1940s, they began then marketing Phoenix as an oasis, and that continues on. That's Val Vista Lakes again. And also, I think the oasis as a compromise is a way of dealing with the cognitive dissonance that is created by conflicting message that comes from the policy arena. In particular, water policy people, they have this water, use it wisely campaign and whatnot. They're trying to get people to conserve water. However, other groups have different messages, and this is my favorite. An ad that was run by the Arizona Office of Tourism, and the slogan was, "The desert is a myth." And this appeared in all of their ads. And so people are constantly bombarded with these conflicting messages and their own values. And I think this oasis is really serving as a mechanism for dealing with cognitive dissonance. So again, in keeping with the conference theme of security and solutions, I've thrown out a few here. Solutions are hard. And I usually am pretty creative at coming up with policy recommendations. In this case, it's a rather bleak scenario, especially when you realize that the oasis landscaping is very far away from where we need to be in order to meet the demand for water over the next 40 years. So something has to give. Usually when I give a talk like this, the first question, because I'll beat you to the point, why don't we just make the water really expensive? Well, why don't we make gas really expensive? Okay, let's put a $2 gas tax on it tomorrow. How much is that really going to reduce how much people drive? Are those people going to get elected the next time there's an election? No. They did this in Tucson, and almost everybody on the board was voted out of office in the next election when they put. So this is political suicide. They're just not going to go there. Perhaps we could emphasize the economic implications and talk about housing values and these types of things, in addition to environmental responsibility, which does seem to be making some headway. Coordinate message between public agencies, that's an obvious one. When we talk about landscaping, talk about xeriscaping and not necessarily desert landscaping.